Okay, so I'll put my go on my noose. Oops. Okay, so in the evening we have the opportunity to ask questions so you can find the answers to the meaning of life, and then you don't have to work again. You don't have to ask again. Ajahn Brahm, why do you work so hard? I don't work hard. That is a myth. That is fake news. No, sometimes you work hard, sometimes you don't work hard. So just do as much service as you can possibly do. How to be when the world around one expects and demands one to do. And then one responds by doing. How does one do from a neutral place? Free of desire, ill will, and still give it everything you've got. Thank you. Easy. Just become a monk or a nun. That's what we do. They demand you to do, but just, you've got all these skillful means. When people ask me to do something, I always say, I'll think about it. And I do think about it, but you know, it sometimes takes a long time before you get around to finding an answer. So, invitations, writing articles, going to people's places, they demand me to go and do it. Because I say, no, I'm not going to do it. They get very upset, and they argue with me. So I never say no, but I never say yes. I do the middle way, which is I'm thinking about it. And I'm sure I'm going to die thinking about many of these things. So if you do respond by doing something, you know, you choose how you can best make use of your time. You are a limited resource. We're all limited resources. So you try the best you possibly can. And free of desire, it will still give everything you've got. When it's time to do something, you give doing everything you've got. When it's time to relax, you give relaxing everything you've got. Without feeling guilty. So that's an amazing thing. If you're nice and wise, you don't need to feel guilty for taking a nap. You know, if you bring yourself your cushion and your blanket and your pillow in here and you just go up in the corner over there and have a nice snooze during my talk. Are you going to feel guilty about that? No, you shouldn't feel guilty, and I won't feel guilty when I throw something at you. No, in other words, that, you know, we're kind, compassion rules. And of course, it's not, it's the old story again, it's not about me. I am not sacrificing myself for others. Nor is this about selfishness, about what's in it for me. It's never about me. It's never about you. It's about us. Yeah, we're in it together. So if I get stressed out and I get cranky, then I give terrible talks. Have a nice rest. Then you get nice talks afterwards. So it's in your interest to look after me. And it's my interest to look after you. So it's just when you change the attitude of, you know, why am I working so hard? I'm not working so hard, we're working hard, or we're having a rest, whichever way you want to look at it. To me, it's just, well, you've got to do something, so I might as well just be here answering these silly questions. They're not silly questions. All questions are important. Why is it so hard to stop all wanting, taking years of practice? It's not so hard. Thinking about it is the hard part. Not doing it is easy. Just sit there and just have a cup of tea and just watch the trees grow. Is that hard? Simplest thing in the world. Unfortunately, we've had all this idea of like guilt. We're supposed to be doing something. And even when I was a kid, you know, brought up in that Christianity where they said the devil makes work for idle hands. It doesn't. No, it makes work for sort of busy hands. The more busy, the more problems you make in this world. So it would be wonderful just to have just a nice peaceful time. This is one of the meditations, I'll probably teach this sometime later on, but this is a preview of it. Some of you have done this little skill for me. You start meditating, and then you imagine you're the Buddha, already enlightened. And just a bit of role playing. So you sit down there, you're the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Finished, enlightened, nothing more to do. Everything just disappeared. No sense of self, no desire, no wanting, because everything which was ever there to be done has been completed. And you just imagine that, what it must feel like. Nothing to do, no one to impress, no more goals to get, no more tests to pass. You're just totally free. Now, can you get that feeling? That's just relaxing, not doing stuff. And it's just so peaceful, so wonderful. So little by little, we just get you to feel what it must be like to not do anything. And not to be judged. And not to judge yourself. You can just be. So this is a powerful little teaching here, but that gets to the nub of what we're doing here. Not trying to attain enlightenment, because people don't know what enlightenment is. What are you trying to attain? It's like getting on a bus, not knowing where the destination is. So, you know, do I really want to get there? Well, I don't know really what it is. So instead of doing that, which is, as I said this morning, you got this beautiful little simile of like following the stream out of the mist. Little by little, you can feel, oh, this feels good. It's going in the right direction, more peace. A little by little, you get the little insights, little glimpses of, I don't need to do anything. I can just sit here and just be. I don't need to attain, to strive, to do anything. Just relax. And little by little, you start to experiment with that, and you will find that during these next 8 days, or however long it is, that sometimes you'll just be sitting here striving, trying to, you know, do some meditation and getting nowhere, and sometimes you just say, oh, I'll just give up. You're just sitting here and doing nothing, and it all comes together. And that's where you start to learn, hey, why is it when I put so much effort, really struggled, tried to sort of put all these little strategies into place and it didn't work, and I just said, I'll just sit here and just let go, relax, and you find things get better. And meditation starts to really take off. And already, the instructions in this morning's talk, just learning how to do that with your own body. You get feedback straight away. You know, your body relaxes, it feels good. You know, it feels just open and free, and aches and pains just don't happen. Things flow properly. Just like simple things. I'm sure that you've been to the letting go room many times today. Sometimes to do a number one, sometimes to do a number two. And you know what happens when people control and they force and they've got to get it out quick because, you know, they need to sort of go to lunch or whatever. What happens? You get hemorrhoids. And that's so similar when you try to meditate. You get hemorrhoids of the brain. Trying to let go. Come on, get out of here. Let go, let go. You get the message, don't you? So I say, just relax. No matter what time it takes, just relax. When you relax everything, this is right, just being. And of course, things flow smoothly without any problem at all. So easy. Anyway. Does one need to cultivate metta, or does it come through letting go meditation? It comes through letting go meditation. It comes, metta is letting go. You don't actually don't really cultivate anything in this place. People spend all their lives cultivating stuff, and what do they ever get? Nothing really. Cultivate this and cultivate that, and just what happens is that notice. I'll give you the deep teachings here that. When you just start to cultivate, what are you cultivating? Why? Because somebody told you it's supposed to be good. You just, like that story I told, I think on last Friday night, just, there was one of the monks. He grew up in Mundijong, which is just very close by to here. His father was a farmer. And he said that one day that he went out into the paddock to check on the sheep, And he doesn't know how this started, but the sheep had formed a circle around a big patch of bushes, so they couldn't see the other side. But like a good sheep, they were just following the one in front. And the one in front was following the one in front of that, and they'd actually formed a circle, which means those sheep would have been going around that circle, you know, for the next 20 or 30 years until one of the sheep died or something, because that's what sheep do. They'll go round and round following the one in front. And he was very fortunate. He could actually see that, so he just took one of the sheep and put it out of the line to actually to stop that circle. And that's a wonderful simile of the Buddha. Just take one person out of the line so you don't keep following each other, cultivating something, because the sheep in front of you told you, oh, you should cultivate this. It's good for you. Why? So instead, we don't cultivate things. We stop and find out where we are, who we are, what's going on right now. Instead of looking for the future, how about the present moment? What is this? What's happening right now? Why do you want to cultivate? What's wrong with this moment? Who said it was wrong? Because if you want to get somewhere, that is called desire, craving, wanting. It is the cause of suffering. If you don't want this, that's another form of wanting, the ill will. So this is good enough for me. I'm just going to be here, not cultivate anything, just to be, see what happens. And then you're actually being here. You're no wanting. Stopping wanting, ending wanting, renouncing, letting it be. That is when things get very peaceful. So simple. So, I wouldn't sort of cultivate metta. If you're cultivating it, you're doing ill will. This isn't good enough, but metta. You know, in a few minutes I'll get my metta going. That's just like the sheep following one another. What is the best practice? Practice something. Practice method to tackle an addiction. The best way to tackle an addiction, you ought to find out what you're addicted to, first of all. Because some addictions are really worthwhile. I'm addicted to tea. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I was even, all the different names for tea, like cha. That's why I was addicted to Ajahn Chah. That inclination to tea was very, very important to me. And so it depends what addiction you're addicted to. I'm also addicted to meditating. I'm trying to get off it. People say, come on, we can cure you. No way. So it's sometimes, what is an addiction anyway? These are just places you go for some happiness, for some peace. So addictions are good. You get the right ones. Not the ones which take you into more suffering and more pain and just more problems, but the good addictions. Addictions to your precepts, being a good person. Addicted to kindness. Addicted to teddy bears. That's a really good addiction. Because it's kind and it's soft and it brings about this beautiful kindness, softness, compassion. But if it's addicted to, I don't know, just alcohol or drugs or pornography or football, I don't know what people are addicted to. But after a while, sort of get a better addiction. So an addiction to peace. I don't know if you like music, just a beautiful silence in the early morning with the wind just blowing through the trees. Greatest music next to silence. Silence is even better than that. Or you're addicted to the highs of like drugs. You just sit there and really get still and get the mind really high on meditation. Wow, that's so neat. There was this poor fellow, and now he got into the real big addictions of heroin. And oh, just. It's some people, this is what I've heard. I'm not the expert on these things, obviously, but they said that some people, they can take a hit of heroin and it doesn't do anything to them. Other people, they just take it and that's it, just one hit, and they're addicted almost forever. And he said that really trying hard to overcome it, so he came to Bodhinyana Monastery some years ago. And, you know, just to try and do the cold turkey. And, you know, it was working for a while, but he told me just what it felt like. He said just 1,000 times every day he has to say no. One time he says yes and he's back on the addiction again. Just in 1,000 to 1. All the time say no, 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 no. And then just that one time he takes it again. But he was doing well in his meditation. The reason I say this is because I was teaching him some meditation. He actually got a very deep meditation, but it wasn't enough. And that's when he sort of came up to me and he said that, and he said, I never thought I'd be able to say this to anybody, but, you know, the deep meditation was more blissful than the heroin. And he said, no, you've heard me say this before many times, the bliss of meditation is better than sex. But apparently heroin is much better than sex. And he said that now he realized that meditation is better than all of those. So, you know, just in sheer intensity of pleasure. So sometimes you can get some meditation going. That really helps because it gets rid of a lesser pleasure for something which is a higher pleasure, a safer pleasure, through deep meditation. That may be the way of doing it. But the last of it, the tackle on addiction, is to also put yourself in a situation where you're not tempted. So in other words, you know, you leave your old friends who just got you into trouble in the first place. You associate with good people, and that could really help you. And there is, I shouldn't really tell his name, but there was a young man. His father was, you know, very wealthy, and you know, he was in Singapore, and he got addicted to heroin. And his dad was really good. He sent him over to Bodhinyana Monastery. And it was not just, you know, being off the substance for a while, but it's also just hanging around really, really good people and positive people. And he said that more than anything else just got him off. And so, you know, he could get off that drugs. And now he's a very, very successful businessman himself. It's very nice to see him just say, you know, basically you saved my life. Got me off the heroin and now he's married, just had a kid. So it's wonderful when these things happen, that a bit of meditation, good company, being around good people, and a bit of support, and then you can get off it. I once had a voice telling me, now is the time to go meditating. And I sat down to get the instant stillness and achieve the spark for the fire to 10 minutes. But I was worried about endless of work wanting to do, and I got out of the meditation. Now I no longer get the voice and achieve the instant stillness easily. How to get back the voice? Record it on your iPhone. Now is the time to meditate and keep it going all the time. Ah, the feeling for me to do meditation easily. The voice, actually, it was my own voice talking to myself. Yeah, great. Gives you some wise there, and you know, you're getting some nice stillness. And one other thing is working hard, that first question. You find if you do some good meditation, you get energized, so you can actually do more without getting so stressed and so tired. So that voice should actually come back again. Yeah, you do. Endless, worried about the endless of work wanting to do. That was the story. Okay. I always like the stories, forget about the questions. The story of the monkeys. Because you've heard about a monkey mind. And people keep thinking monkey mind is just a restless mind, but it's much deeper than that. So a long time ago in Sri Lanka, It was one of the big holy days, a big festival, when lots and lots of people went to the temple. And of course, when there's so many people going, there's so much food, that sooner or later somebody's going to drop something. And so the monkey went to the temple just waiting for the opportunity. Someone to drop a banana or leave it on a plate unattended, or a mango or something, and then go and steal it for his lunch. Because, you know, it was lots of food, lots of hustle and bustle, so it was a great opportunity for monkeys. So the monkey was there waiting for someone to sort of drop something or leave something so he could have his lunch. And he was listening to the monk who was giving a sermon on meditation. And the monk happened to mention monkey mind. And the monkey was really interesting. Oh, he's talking about us. I never realized that. And so the monkey paid attention and listened to this priest. And when he found out that this monk was saying a monkey mind is a bad mind, you're supposed to train yourself so you don't have a monkey mind, because a monkey mind just stops you being peaceful, stops you being smart, keeps you being stupid. Monkey minds are bad. And the monkey was really offended. You know, in these days of equity and, you know, not discriminating against species or whoever, you know, we can't discriminate these days. Even I heard that in Brussels, the European Union, they had such a strict non-discrimination policy. If someone could do the job, you get the job. Doesn't matter how old, what race, what religion or whatever. So when a dog applied for a secretary position in the UN, they couldn't just dismiss it because of its species wasn't human. So they asked the dog, said, well, can you type? So the dog went on the chair, it just clicked the mouse, opened up a Word document, and he typed this incredible, beautiful letter. He could type. So I said, okay, can you open up a spreadsheet? So I opened up Excel, made a beautiful spreadsheet. Amazing. I said, but this is the European Union, so you have to be able to speak a second language. So the dog went, meow, meow. Oh, come on, it's an old joke, but meow, second language. The dog as well as Wolf Wolf. Okay, now where was I? Oh yeah, in the you can't say this about monkeys, that monkey minds are bad. I've got a monkey mind, it's okay. That's discrimination. You shouldn't, don't know what you're talking about. So I was really offended. So he went right back in the jungle and told the leader of his troop, what he'd heard. And all the other monkeys, they heard the same. And they were jumping up and down, getting really upset. You can't do this. This is wrong. This is not correct. You can't offend monkeys like this. They're jumping up and down, complaining. And then the head monkey, who'd been there a long time, said, see, that's what's called a monkey mind. And all the monkeys said, oh, yeah, that's true. Theory is one thing, but experience of the monkey mind jumping up and down, complaining. Oh, yeah. So what can we do about it, said the monkeys. And so the head monkey said, well, look, I've been to that monastery as well, and what they do to overcome the monkey mind, they sit down to meditate. So all the monkeys jumped up and down, yeah, let's meditate, we want to meditate, we want to get rid of the monkey mind, even though we're monkeys, but we can do something. Jumping up and down, making fuss and bother. Okay, but how do we meditate? Well, I've seen, first of all, you've got to get a cushion. So let's get a cushion. So they went into the forest, they got some grass, they got some leaves, they got stuff, and they made a nice little zafu for themselves. And now what do we do? Now we sit down, right paw over the left paw, back straight, chin in, close your eyes and watch your breath. So all the monkeys did that. They sat down, right paw over the left paw, thumb slightly touching, the back straight, chin down, closed their eyes and started watching their breath. The first time ever that monkeys meditated. The forest had never been so quiet. for about 30 seconds. One of the monkeys put their hand up. Excuse me, excuse me. I've been thinking. You know, we agreed this morning at lunchtime we'd go and raid the banana plantation where everyone's off at the temple for our lunch. I've been thinking about that. So he said, let's get that out of the way first of all. We get that out of the way. And the other monkey said, yeah, I've been thinking the same. Let's do that first of all, and then we can come and meditate. Then we don't have to think about it. Get it all finished first of all. So, yeah. So they all went up from their cushions, swang through the jungle to the plantation. No one was around because they were at the temple. And stole all these bananas, but they weren't going to eat it yet. It wasn't lunchtime yet. They put all the bananas in a big heap in the middle of the clearing, and then they went back onto their little cushions. Sat down, right paw of the left paw, thumbs touching, back straight, head chinned in, watching their breath, breathing in, breathing out. Excuse me, said one of the monkeys. You know, I've been thinking. Before we eat those bananas, we have to peel them first. That's true. Yeah, it's true. I've been thinking the same. So let's peel them first to get that out of the way, so then we can meditate. So they peeled all the bananas to make them all prepared. Didn't eat anything yet. Wasn't at lunchtime. They went back on their seats, right paw to left paw, back straight, chin in, watching their breath, breathing in, breathing out. Excuse me, said another monkey. I've been thinking too. You know, before we eat those bananas, we've got to put them in our mouth first of all. So let's do that. Let's get that out of the way. So all the monkeys picked up a banana each and put it in their mouth. And there's always one or two monkeys put two in. One put three in. So there's monkeys with bananas sticking out of their mouth. But they weren't eating it yet. It's meditation time. Sat again on their cushions. Right paw over their left paw, thumbs touching, back straight, chin in. Closed their eyes. And of course, as soon as they all had their eyes closed, they ate all those bananas. And then they got up and left, and that was the end of their meditation. That is what we mean by monkey mind. I'll get this out of the way first, and then I'll meditate. And what happens is life is out of the way before you ever meditate. So that's the real monkey mind, the cause of the restlessness. I'll do this first. All the jobs you have to do in life. And of course, you know the answer, that what's done is finished. So everything's finished. It's done. So you can just rest and relax. And don't be a monkey and get it out of the way first. And then I'll meditate. Dear Ajahn, how does one deal with sounds when meditating? Because unlike eyes, we cannot close our ears. Oh, you can just put big... you got those in there. You can just get some get some tissues, whatever you can stuff in there. But it's not just stuffing, because it also the vibrations in your bones, they also conduct the sound. So what does one do? If a sound happens, I mentioned this morning, great teaching of Ajahn Chah, it's not the sound disturbs you. It's you who disturb the sound. Sounds are natural. There's no way that you can live in any place where there's absolutely no sound at all. Human beings make sounds. They burp. They cough. They sometimes let out wind from their back. And I should have mentioned this earlier, that out of compassion, if you do have bad digestion and you're passing wind, please, out of compassion for everybody else, sit at the back. Because if you sit at the front, there's so many other people have to smell what comes out from you, and that's very unkind. But if you sit at the back, just only the wall feels that. So that is a compassionate thing to do. If you pass wind. And so you also know just why all the people sitting in the back now. Anyway, what was the sound? So what we do, if there is a sour, we just let it be. We don't add to the sound. So somebody coughs. They shouldn't cough. I was about to get enlightened. Why do they have to cough? They're spreading diseases. It's a terrible thing. We should do, like I've seen this because I go traveling a lot. In some of these, there we go. Get out of here. You know, in some of these airports, they have these like infrared cameras. They can tell if you've got a fever, if you're sick, if you've got a cough. So we can put one in the front over there with this, this big fellow with tattoos and just like about, what's it called? The bouncer in a nightclub, yeah. Get one of those guys, security. And anybody who's a bit high temperature coughing, you get out. Now, already the cough has stopped a long time ago, but you're thinking about it, and so that is called disturbing the sound. You just, the sound's only just a second, and it's gone. But when we think about it, and we complain about it inside, that sound reverberates sometimes all night. The sound's already gone. So don't think about it. But if it is lasting a long time, then we change our attitude towards the sound. Instead of getting negative, which makes us really tense, we can't find any peace at all, we change our relationship to the sound. So, one of the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery, 2 or 3 years ago, his brother was visiting from Europe, and there was no space. So he said, can my brother stay for a couple of days? I said, well, where? There's no place for him. He said, oh, he's my brother. We grew up together. We can share a room together. And I said, look at your age. Your brother's probably about the same age. Guys at your age snore. He said, well, I thought about that already, he said. So what my plan is, I'll go to sleep first. Because whoever goes to sleep first has a good night's sleep. It's the other one who's in big trouble. That's my plan, he said. So, are you sure you can do that? He said, well, yeah, it's my brother anyway. So, that was the plan. So when they went into the, I mean, the small little huts we live in, you know, just like your rooms, just two people in there. So his brother fell asleep first. So this monk, soon after about 1 minute after he fell asleep, this really heavy snoring, like an elephant, like a jumbo taking off from the airport. Just like really, really loud noise. And so he was in big trouble. He said, well, my brother's always fast asleep already, but he had this huge snoring. What should I do? And so he remembered the instructions. It's not the snoring disturbs you, you disturb the snoring. So he started using the way we can perceive things. We can perceive things in so many different ways. So he chose to perceive his brother snoring, what not with negativity, but with a positive mind. You know, being sort of highly educated from Europe, he decided to imagine his brother's snoring like some experimental, cutting-edge, state-of-the-art music. Because it did have a rhythm, but the rhythm was like a chaotic rhythm. You know, it did have some beat behind it, but, you know, it was very, very complex. And just the melody was just something which challenged our usual conventions of what musical melody really is. It was really artistic. In other words, you couldn't understand it. So, but anyway, he did that, and he kept just imagining just how beautiful and avant-garde, you know, this snoring was. Until he woke up in the morning, and the last thing he remembered, he told me, was just how beautiful the snoring appeared. And then he woke up. He'd gone to sleep, fast asleep for a long time. Very good example of how, yeah, there can be noise. If we can sort of escape from it, wonderful. But if we can't, don't think about it. But if it still persists, then change your attitude towards it. Beautiful, soft music. And then you drift off into a deep sleep. People tell me that sometimes that a lot of people, not just one, that the only way they can go to sleep at night is by listening to one of my Dhamma talks. I didn't realize they were that bad. But at least let somebody get some happiness from them. Okay, a moral dilemma. I saw a millipede writhing in pain, being attacked by ants. My instinct was to brush away the ants and place the millipede in the same place. I figured that the ants only lost a meal, whereas the millipede would have lost his life. So, what should you do? So either way, sometimes by that time the millipede is already sort of so badly injured, and if it survives, it will have post-traumatic stress for the rest of its life. So I don't know what to do there, but nature is like that sometimes. So sometimes if we just try and save something, interfering with nature, sometimes it gets more complicated. So anyway, whichever you did, if you did it with kindness, that's the best you could do. If we accidentally step on a millipede and it doesn't die, it's only injured, should we kill it and put it out of its misery or just let it be? Oh, well, if it's already just dead or dying, and, because, it's people have vegetarian food, you can actually put it in the food there for some extra protein for people, because it's not killing, it's already dead. It's like roadkill. Extra protein for people. The vegetarian roadkill. Put it out of its misery. How do you know if it's, if it's out of its misery? It's usually you're putting it out of your misery, because you don't like to see things suffer. So usually, that even animals, if you're very, very sick, and sometimes, you go and visit your grandma, who's really sick in hospital, and say, "Grandma, do you want to be put out of your misery?" That's not a very nice thing to do, is it? So the same, just treat animals. It's not your job there, but they would usually leave them alone. And that's what I would do anyway. In my meditation, but that's one of the nice things why in this place I never wear my shoes, except when I go back to Bodhnyana Monastery, or go out of the main compound here, because on the concrete, on the paths, it's really clean. There's not much dirt there. And if you haven't got shoes on, it's actually, you're more mindful of not stepping on those millipedes or anything else. So, if you don't wear your shoes, you find less millipedes actually get squashed. How do we know, choose, decide on a meditation object suitable to our temperament? There, sometimes, as a teacher, I usually start people with basically anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath. But if they can't do mindfulness, anapanasati, I usually teach them breath meditation. And if the breath meditation doesn't work, I teach them loving kindness meditation. But if loving kindness is not good for them, then I teach them metta. If metta doesn't work for them, then I teach them insight meditation. If they can't do insight, I teach them vipassana. And if they can't do vipassana, then I teach them letting go meditation. If they can't do letting go meditation, then I teach them anapanasati. By that time, they don't realize that's where they started from. Because there's no difference. That is just one of the myths, to think there's a difference. Meditation is just letting go. That's all. When I was a student over in London, Christmas time, I used to get jobs in the post office because I always needed extra time. Before, he had emails, all this extra mail for Christmas time. So I used to get a job there, and I was working in the post office in Acton. And they asked me, they gave me the big bag, can you open up the post boxes? They had just in the main post office in Acton. They had the three slots. One was for local mail, one was for the country, the other one was for international. So, you looked at where you're going to send it. If it was to the local in London, you put it in one slot, and the other middle slot was for the countryside, UK, and overseas, the third slot. So I opened up, had the key, opened it up, and found out that those three slots all fed into the same baskets. just on the outside, oh, nicely organized, but you know, just all goes in the same. Sort them out in the office. And I thought, what a great simile about meditation that is. Yeah, you might think you do Vipassana, but it all goes into the same slot, okay. So you think you're doing one thing, but it's all. And Ajahn Chah, he put his hand up, he said, can you see the front of my hand? You can see all the front of my hand. Now you can see the back of my hand, you can't see the front of my hand, but they're there together. You can't have a front without a back. So you might think you're doing back of the hand meditation, but the front of the hand is coming with you. You might think you're doing front of the hand meditation, but the back of the hand is going with you as well. You call that Samatha Vipassana. They always go together. And I also have metta as well. From previous training, I'm used to doing a parikama. A parikama means just a preliminary, such as buddho, mental recitation, to maintain mindfulness in daily postures activities. However, I'm not sure whether to continue to use the buddho for sitting meditation or just silent the mind by focusing on the breath. If I use buddho for sitting, there is a consistency in my meditation object. I focus on the breath for sitting, the mind is more silent. May I have your advice? When you came here to Jhana Grove, some of you came from overseas. You came in an aircraft, but the aircraft could not land in Jhana Grove. It landed in the airport. From the airport, you took a taxi or a car to come to Jhana Grove, but the taxi, the car, could not get into your cottage. So you had to get out of the car and walk in your slippers or shoes to the front door of your cottage. But you're not allowed to wear your shoes inside the cottage. So you take the shoes off and you go barefoot into your room. Different vehicles for different tasks. The same with meditation. You can use buddho for the beginning of your meditation. But don't go too far. There comes a time when you have to discard it and just go to just the bare breath without any buddha, without any saying of anything. That's just the beginning. First two stages of anapanasati, yeah, you can do buddha. But then you have to drop the buddha and just go to the full awareness of the breath and then the delightful breath and then nimittas and then jhanas. You can't be doing buddho while you're in nimitta stage. It's just too coarse. So every part of meditation has its use, but it's not all the time. Even sometimes people talk about breath meditation. Always be aware of your breath. No. There comes a time when you get way past the breathing. Sometimes these beautiful lights called nimittas come up in your meditation, and you say, well, I can't be aware of the breath. And you support everything by going back to your breath. So we don't do that. There's a time for everything. So the buddho is great for the very beginning, but don't do it too long. When the mind gets peaceful, buddho has done its job. Now go to what comes next. Whoops. Several times during meditation, I got these premonitions that came true. Can you explain this phenomena? I knew you were going to say that. No, do they always come true? Sometimes very close to coming true, but sometimes you don't really understand it. Just like that disciple some years ago, he had a premonition. Oh, no, this is actually just last October. This is a great premonition. It wasn't a premonition, but he had this really weird dream. He dreamt, and he came and told me this, he dreamt he was a strand of spaghetti. It's weird, but you know, you got to sort of, you know, you shouldn't demean somebody when they come up and said they had this really weird idea they were a strand of spaghetti. And yeah, he was an Italian by birth, so you know, a bit to be understood. But the next day, he dreamt he was a piece of ravioli. And I got it straight away. I hope you can understand this. Is it? He was recollecting his past lives. passed a lot. Well, forget it. But you get premonitions. Sometimes they're true, but sometimes they're not at all. The thing is, you cannot trust them. Just one of the monks I was in Thailand with, he was from the United States, and he told me he had these two premonitions in his life. Actually, he had three, but two of them had come true. The first one, because his father lived in, or was in a really Pasadena, and was quite well off, so had this swimming pool in the back, and he had this premonition that his sister drowned in the swimming pool. Had it many times, and he was just lounging by the pool one afternoon, and then his premonition started to play out exactly as he'd seen in his dreams. And because he knew what was going to happen next, he intervened. He saved his sister's life. He said, if I hadn't had that premonition, I wouldn't have sort of acted in time. So he actually saved his sister's life because of the premonition. And the second time, a little bit later on in life, he was backpacking in New Zealand. And in those days, it was the 60s, 70s, he was in a house with other young people smoking marijuana. He had a premonition that the police came and arrested everybody. But, when you smoke marijuana, you're not really all that alert enough to actually to act on your premonitions, because it did come true. And he got deported. And he thought, how stupid I was, got all these warnings. But the next one, he said, he told me many times that his premonition, he was totally sure this is how his life was going to end. That during the Vietnam War, the Viet Cong or the Pathet Lao or the Khmer Rouge were going to invade that part of Thailand, and he was going to be killed running across a paddy field, being shot in the head by one of the communist insurgents into Thailand. And he told me that many times. He said, look, these other two worked out, happened. This was exactly the same. This is how I'm going to die. But, he actually disrobed, he got married, and he died in a head-on car crash, not sort of somebody shooting him. So that one was totally wrong. So it's premonitions. Sometimes it's amazing just how true they are, but sometimes they don't work out at all. And in my own family, I was telling Dennis Shepherd this yesterday, Friday, that my auntie, she's really my mother's cousin, but because my grandmother and my grandmother's sister only had one child each, both girls. So one was my mum, the other one was my auntie, but they just grew up together like sisters. So this was after the Second World War, that they went out to, just for fun, went to these mediums. Just to see, a way to pass the day. Didn't believe in it at all. But then the medium looked at my auntie and said to her, you are soon going to meet your husband. It was a bit weird. And his name will be Donald Wolfries. Donald is a common name. Wolfries is a very strange name. And no, this happened, I checked it with my auntie and my mother so many times, it happened. And a few days later, at a dance, nice young man came up, would you like to dance? That's what they did in those days. I said, yeah. And said, what's your name? Donald. Uh-oh. Surname Wolfries. And they were married for over 60 years. He just passed away about a year and a half ago. 60 years they were married together. And this medium predicted the name of the person they're going to marry. Not an ordinary name. So it's amazing. Sometimes premonitions turn out to be true, but sometimes not. Anyway, when one has developed jhanas, does the consciousness stay outside the body? No. It's even in the jhanas. It's not outside the body. It's not inside the body. It's just in its own realm. The rupa loka or arupa loka instead of the karma loka. So a totally different realm of existence, the jhanas. It's not physically inside or outside. A stream winner eradicates self-illusion, Sakaiditi. What is Sakaiditi? Is this the same as anatta? It is, yes, the same as realizing anatta, to understand that all those things you took to be a self, to be me, to be mine, aren't yours at all, such as all your different types of consciousness. And your will does not belong to you. That's always scary when I say that. What? I'm not in control of my own will. Exactly. Scary stuff, but it's good fun. In formal meditation practice, do we remain and simply enjoy the stillness and tranquility? Is there a point where we should direct the still mind towards insight or analytical vipassana meditation to identify and uproot defilements and delusions? No. You don't do things. When you are still, the purpose of stillness is that you suppress this thing called doing, controlling, driving your own bus. And you allow this to unfurl naturally. So you get so deep into stillness, it's not just enjoy it, it's profound stuff, scary stuff sometimes, so deep. And you don't appoint where you should direct the still mind. If you are directing something, it's not still anymore. So you're really, really still, and you don't do insight meditation. What happens is as you come out of that stillness, it's such profound, such clear, five hindrances vanish, which means your mind is incredibly clear and courageous. And what you see is just where you've just been, and there you can actually see through many of the delusions. Otherwise, we see what we want to see, and we deny what we don't want to see. So this is what happens in stillness. You get incredible, powerful insights, which you don't expect, you don't do it, it just happens. The enlightenment is a natural process, said the Buddha. Can I meditate during a bush walk? Of course you can meditate during a bush walk, but you won't get into jhanas during the bush walk, because if you get into jhanas, you just carry on walking, because your awareness of your body vanishes and you're just aware of your mind. So you just keep carrying on walking. You may end up in the Indian Ocean if you go that way, or may end up in Sydney if you go the other way. Just walk, 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 walk. So, but you can be mindful. You can be in this moment during a bush walk, fine. Oh, the unseen beings, devas, get attracted to people who are meditating. Same question applies to people who do chanting. If it's you are a good person, of course you attract good beings. But if it's the spirits and the bad, because what people ask these questions for, because over in Asia people think, oh, when you meditate, all these bad spirits will come close to you. And who knows, maybe they might possess your body. Now that, of course, is gomayang. Remember that word, gomayang? Because if you are a very good, pure-hearted person, then these beings can't come close to you. They're just the standard story. It's just the way that this person described it. It was another medium story. It was a Thai girl many, many years ago, came over here, and really devout Buddhist, and her father had passed away, so her mother was alone in Thailand. So she, in those days, you get visas like family, support visas, whatever it was. And so she got a visa for her elderly mother to come over to Perth. And after a couple of years, her elderly mother got quite sick, was in hospital. And you know, she looked after her mother so well, just slept, didn't need a bed, just slept on the floor next to her mum. So the nurses, no one can look after you like your son or daughter can. So she was just so kind. But then the illness kept on going on and on and on. So she decided, the daughter, to find out whether the illness would kill her mother. It was the last illness. So she went to a medium. And a medium would charge $20 and would leave her body and would just find out, you know, whether her mother would survive the illness or not. And no, she was only for $20, not that much. And she was quite highly regarded, this medium. But all she needed to do was to know not even the name of her mum, just the hospital, the ward, and the room number. And she'd just go and check it. So, gave her the $20, and she went into a trance. And about 10, 15 minutes later, the medium came out, and the first thing she did was give the $20 back. And the Thai girl said, her name was Ratana, the Thai girl. Ratana said, well, couldn't you find my mum? She said, oh yeah, I found her. I found the hospital, I found the ward, the room, but I could not get into her room. She said, there was a big force field around your mother. I've never seen this before. No, that's why I give the $20 back. I couldn't sort of get close enough to find out. She said, who the heck is your mother? And she said, she is a Thai nun. She's been ordained for about 30 or 40 years, keeping 8 precepts, meditating. And at that, the medium snatched the $20 back. You should have told me, you've been wasting my time. People like me, said the medium, can't get close to people like that. And that was a wonderful way they said it, and that's just so true. If you are a meditator, precepts, compassion, kindness, other beings can't get close to you. So they feel there's like a force field around you and they just can't penetrate it. Even years ago, there was she was a medium as well, quite a good one. And she came to visit me at Bodhinyana Monastery some years ago. I had a chat and then afterwards she left. And it was only the next time she visited, she actually told me that she'd brought an Aboriginal elder, an Indigenous man, to come and see me. But the Indigenous man, as soon as he was coming into Bodhinyana Monastery, said, I can't come in here. And he had to get out. And he was sensitive enough. And I just scolded the medium afterwards. Her name was Barbara. And told her, look, you should, all you need to do is ask my permission. And he could have come in. Sensitive enough to realize, you know, there's power around these people. So, say with other beings. You've all got sort of power around you, but some more than others. And if it's a bad being, they can't come close to you. Dvajan Brahm, with praise and blame, you have mentioned that to be like a lotus, let both just slide off. How do we do that with metta and gratitude? Yeah, you know, with a lotus, if you pee on a lotus, all the urine just flows off, and the lotus smells as it did before. If you pour Chanel number 5 over the lotus, that also rolls off and it smells just as it did before. So the lotus doesn't keep any of the smell. It's got its own smell, its own purity. So that is with praise and blame. How many times people have praised you for something you didn't do? How many times they blamed you for things you didn't do? Because praise and blame, how can we do that? You praise someone. Why do you praise them for? You don't really know what really went on. And if you blame them, you don't know the difficult situation they were in to have acted like that. So praise and blame that. After a while, when I looked at somebody who was, I wanted to praise them or blame them, I didn't have enough evidence. I couldn't really judge. There was just too many things I just didn't understand or didn't know. So how can you praise anybody or blame anybody? So in the end, they're the owners of their karma, nothing to do with me. So that's why praises and blame doesn't make any sense to me. If someone is kind to me or angry at me, I feel I'm so influenced by those. I know your guitar string story, and I know I'm overreacting to others myself, but I can't help it. I appreciate if you would give a little tip to advice about overreacting. That guitar string thing is If you stretch the guitar string, pulling it tight on both ends, and something hits it, it really makes a high-pitched sound. But if you loosen the tension, so it's no tension on it at all, something hits it, it doesn't make a sound at all. We react because of how tense we are. And you can see that sometimes you get a really nice meditation, just so peaceful, like walking on air, and someone calls you, "You stupid idiot, you have just taken my shoes instead of your own," or whatever. You say, "Oh, fine, you can have these ones." You find that when you are just so peaceful and just so joyful in your meditation, that nothing bothers you. You never react almost at all. And you find that, but when you're really tired, you really, people make so much noise in your room, and you haven't had a good night's sleep, and you're sick, and you're jet-lagged, and you've had enough, and just something happens. Just as like a small thing, just, just a suicidal millipede just gets under your feet. I'm trying to, why do you do that for? So whatever happens, you do find that when, you're very tense, tired, no happiness, that's when you overreact. So relax, rest, look at your body, just learn how to relax the body. Tomorrow learn how to relax the mind. And then you'll actually find that you don't react at all. How do I overcome restlessness in meditation? I tried walking, then back to sitting and still feel restless. Then go back to walking again. And then sitting. Walk, sit. That's 5 minutes gone. So you are restless. Ask yourself, where do you want to be? Ask your body, your mind, what do you want? What do you want, body? And if it needs to have a glass of water, give it a glass of water, a cup of tea. Wants to have a stretch out in bed, just take it to bed. What do you want, body? What do you want, mind? Why is it restless? It's because the mind is trying to run away from you, because you're not treating it properly. So if you treat the body with kindness and the mind with gentleness, just, "I'm really kind to my mind." So when I'm sitting here meditating, I say, "Hi, mind. Hey, you're back again. Yay. Do you want to hang out together?" "Yeah, what do you do? Best meditation?" "That's fine by me." So my mind and I, we get to know each other. Known each other, had some wonderful times for so many years. So we hang out together. Do you like hanging out with an enemy? Or someone who's really kind, doesn't tell you what to do, doesn't criticize you? Of course you like hanging out with people like that. So that should be your meditation object. Just whatever it is, your mind, hang out together, chill out together, and then no more restlessness. You don't want to escape from one another because you like one another. I thought meditation is, that's already started wrong, I thought. There is, have you got it somewhere? I think it's in my room. That little cartoon. A man goes to the monk with a big sign. "I want happiness." And he's really upset and angry. "I want happiness." Goes up to the monk. And the monk looks at him, takes the sign away, saying, "First mistake, I." So that's ego, sense of self. So he scrubs up off the eye, off the sign. And what's he got now? "Want happiness." Second problem, wanting. That's craving, desire. So he scrubs that off, the want. And then he holds the sign up. Now what have we got left? Happiness. Problem solved. That's just a beautiful, profound, if you want something, you're going to suffer. And it all comes starting off with the eye, because that's what eye does. It does things, wants things. So scrub off the eye, scrub off the want, that's the only thing left, happiness. I thought meditation is recharge energy, but I've been meditating flat out all day today, just a bit of sitting and walking. I feel so tired and sleepy because you haven't had enough yet. you haven't charged up yet. So give it a time, be patient. Is it normal to feel this way for the first few days? Yes. Or is it special designed bed keep on calling me? No, it's because you ask any sort of psychologist, people are sleep deprived. We work far harder these days than we ever did before. Much is demanded of us. In old days, you know, weekends would be free. Nowadays, we know we've got our iPhones and our tablets and computers. And even on the weekend, we're just always doing stuff. So, you know, we work sort of 7 days a week. The old days didn't have so many things. We didn't have to work so hard. It wasn't so tough. These days, we have to work really hard. So because of that, most people are tired. And because they're tired, they come to a place like this to let go. First thing they do is catch up on sleep deficit. 2 or 3 days, give yourself any time you need to go to have a sleep, just go and take it. And afterwards, you soon catch up after 2 or 3 days, not just 1 day. And when you catch up, oh, you feel so good. Well, look, it was Mahinda, the librarian. head up now. He told me, I was really busy when I went off to Penang and KL, just on the end of other long trips, and then coming back here for the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, New Year's Eve party and New Year's Eve celebration. When I came back here for the New Year's Eve celebration, I think the night before there was come back after New Year's Eve celebration, there was a teleconference for Australia Sangha Association, and that was, after that was the Patimokkha, the recitation for all the monks, and I was just exhausted. So I said, I'm going to have 10 days of just R&R in my hut, in my cave. And so I did that. And I think it was Mahinda said, it's amazing. It's like you've had a makeover. That's what he said. It's just you got your energies back again. So I practice what I preach. You know, just I was relaxing, just sleeping, walking, doing a bit of reading, and just a little bit of meditation, and just let the meditation happen. I never forced anything. And then you get you energized again. So I know how to do that. Ajahn, does consuming vegetarian food help raise one's vibrational energy during meditation? In other words, is it easier to meditate as one would feel less heavy? No, not really. If you like vegetarian food and you can handle vegetarian food, fine. So, you know, whatever happens, whatever you can do, because sometimes people can eat vegetarian food, some people can't. Some people just get energized from it. Some people don't have enough energy from it. So it's really up to you. Vegan food, high lactose, low lactose, whatever it is, whatever actually works for you. So it's not necessary, but it's good if you can. Does insight and self-love appear during meditation or after meditation or product of meditation? When does insight develop? Insight develops at all stages of the meditation. Same with metta. Maybe I will leave that tomorrow, because it's getting a little bit late, and I'll talk a little bit about insight, metta, and meditation in tomorrow morning's talk to get it even more clear. During sitting meditation, I experience strong energy arising, like hot air filling the balloon in my body. I have difficulty observing the breath, and the sensation is there all the time. How can I overcome this solidified energy? Don't overcome it. Take that as your meditation object, be with it, and see what happens. I'm a bit concerned if it's like hot air filling the balloon in my body. I would sit in the back. Just in case. But if that's just your metaphor, then when these things happen, with any distractions in the body, The best thing is just to be with it. It's happening in a moment, and let it be and see what happens. Because when you try and get rid of stuff, it usually just causes all sorts of problems. How can we take our meditation cushions back with us, metaphorically attached to our bums when we go back to family, worker, etc.? It's another 8 days before you go back. So, you know, in the moment, we've only just arrived. You're already planning what to do when you go back. So, what happens is just quite naturally, when you learn, you know, how to meditate, it's, you love doing it. Not because you have to, because you're inclined towards it. Last question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in some books about the Buddha history mentioned his early study with some spiritual teachers. It is said that he had attained some level of deep meditation with them. I remember one of them is called no perception or not non-perception. Are these deep level of meditations related to the jhanas? The book also said that after following these teachers, Gotama was still not answered about self. He then left and found a different way of his own. What was that way? Okay, under those two teachers, Alara Kalama and Uddhaka Ramaputta, he said that in the first, under Alara Kalama, that he had an attainment of nothingness. And that was the same level as his teacher. But the Buddha said that was not going to help him at all. He could not see how that was conducive to enlightenment. With the next teacher, he went to neither perception nor non-perception and said that too couldn't help him. Later on, it is said in many places, including the Atanagara Sutta and the Mahamalunkyaputta Sutta 64 of Majjhima Nikaya, that these, especially the state of nothingness, is conducive to enlightenment. So there's a bit of a contradiction there. But we'll go back to that contradiction in a few moments, where he had those two teachers realize that that wasn't helping him at all. And so he recalled later on, as a 6 or 7 year old young man under the rose apple tree, while his father was doing a plowing ceremony, sitting there killing time, he entered into the first jhana. And he never had that experience since, because he thought all that way back, maybe that is a path to enlightenment. And this is Mahasachaka Sutta number 36 of the Majjhima Nikaya. And the insight, the realization came up, that is the way to enlightenment, to Bodhi, through the jhanas, not through what he did under those other two teachers. So, usually, and I state this as well, the only way you can achieve the arupa states, and there is an arupa state of nothingness, and neither perception or non-perception, is through those jhanas. They are a special case, a refinement of the fourth jhanas. But they could not have been got through those jhanas, because the Buddha would have remembered those and would have said that those are conducive to enlightenment. So, the answer to this, and what most scholars accept these days, is that what Alara Kalama and Uddhaka Ramaputta taught were not the real thing. They were lesser. They weren't based on the jhanas. In the same way that even these days, or not these days, this was some time ago, that when I went to the United States, or maybe 10 years ago, that there was two main insight places, and that was the Insight Meditation Center in Barre, Massachusetts, and I got the message that Joseph Goldstein wanted to have an interview with me. So I rocked up there and had all his senior teachers, And they were just asking me about jhanas. They all knew I was a jhana meditator. And I thought, what are you asking me about jhanas for? I thought you were Vipassana people. He said, oh yeah, but you know, our teacher, Upandita, has been telling us that now we need to do the jhanas. It's not just the pure insight tradition. I said, well, what actually are you doing? And they called it jhana light, L-I-T-E. In other words, it wasn't a real jhana at all. It was just, you know, something which, you know, you could bend and stretch, but it wasn't the real jhana. The real jhanas is, you know, no perception of the body. Five senses gone, no thinking. So they were really trying hard to get those jhanas, because they realized too that you need these. And also, it's the same over in the East Coast, in the Spirit Rock. There, all the senior teachers there were just trying to quiz me on the jhanas. So even the Burmese teachers know that there is no such thing as pure vipassana mentioned anywhere in the suttas, in the word of the Buddha. The jhanas are necessary. In fact, there's so many places you can quote this. Gopika Moggallana Sutta, after the Buddha passed away, Ananda was the go-to person. People who would ask him, what did the Buddha teach? And the Gopa Moggallana, what type of meditation did the Buddha teach? Ananda replied, only taught four types of meditation. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. It's always the case. So after following these teachings, Gautama was still not answered about self, about ending suffering. That was what he was trying to find, or the meaning of what happened. So he found a different way of his own. What that way was the jhanas. That's what it says in the suttas. That's what it says in the Eightfold Path. That's what it says in so many places. The Buddha who discovered the jhanas. That's what it says. Anyway, you will find that out for yourself in a few days. Maybe. A few days, a few years, a few lifetimes. Who knows? But it's going to happen. Otherwise, if it doesn't happen, anyone who's unsatisfied with the retreat, you can always ask for your money back. I promise that. I'm very honest. So if you don't get enlightened or the jhanas, you can ask for your money back. It's stated. You've heard it. You won't get it back, but you're permitted to ask. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay.